Okay, so let's start again. So we are, yesterday we were looking at the gradual training, and today we are sort of going to continue with that. We are up to the idea of sensory strength and right effort. This is part of right effort on the Noble Eightfold Path. And this idea of right effort is very, can be expanded in great detail, because it's all about how to use the mind in the right way, how to think in such a way that you overcome the defilements and you create purity. And this is one of those, if you like, difficult areas, right, to think in the right way. And it takes a lot of wisdom to be able to do this. So for that reason, it's something that you can expand on almost infinitely, about how to think and how to kind of sort of move the mind, so to speak, in the right direction. So this sutta is part of that, and this is called the Dvedavitakka Sutta, the two kinds of thoughts. And this is like an autobiographical sutta, where the Buddha talks about his own life, as we were talking about before. When the Buddha speaks about his own life, and he uses that as an example for everyone to follow. So let's see what he has to say. This is Majjhima number 19. We found it in there, called the two kinds of thoughts. If you haven't found it, it doesn't matter, you can just listen, that's often better, so just see what happens. So, this is how it goes. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, another Pindika's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus. Thus, bhikkhus, Venerable Sir, they replied, and the Blessed One said this, bhikkhus, before my awakening, while I was still an unawakened bodhisattva, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty. Right, so here we see the Buddha before his awakening, while he is still practicing. And obviously the reason why he is talking about this is not just to kind of tell about his life beforehand, but actually to give people some inspiration. So here he's saying about what he did to gain that awakening himself, right? This is what I did. You should be doing the same thing. I should maybe warn you straight away at the very beginning that he says bhikkhus, right? Bhikkhus means anyone who is present. This is how the Pali works. It mentions kind of the main category. The bhikkhus are probably considered the main category, perhaps because there was most of them. They were often the most senior in the assembly, all these kind of things. They were the main. But it includes bhikkhunis, it includes often also lay people as well, all apart. Part and parcel of the audience to some of these discourses. So it's not an exclusive kind of thing. So, and then here, straight away, we're talking about this idea of before my awakening, while I was a bodhisattva. Somebody asked about the bodhisattva yesterday, right? So here you are. This is one of those suttas where the word bodhisattva occurs. And it occurs almost always in this context, when the Buddha is talking about his practice before he became the Buddha, while he was still the Buddha to be. This is where it actually occurs. And for that reason, as I was saying yesterday, the idea of the bodhisattva is quite possibly related to the Sanskrit word bodhisattva, rather than bodhisattva. And bodhisattva means somebody with intent on, somebody searching for enlightenment or awakening, right? It makes quite good sense. While bodhisattva means enlightenment being, it's a little bit weird, enlightenment being. It's not as obvious as the person who is intent on awakening it. So that is the thing there. Okay, this is very different from Mahayana ideas, and it has a very kind of way of looking at this word, which kind of fits very well in with the ideas of early Buddhism. So, and then he thought, suppose I divide my thoughts into two classes. On the one hand, thoughts of sensual desire, right? Any kind of, pretty much any kind of desire that arises in the mind, in terms of sensual pleasures, thoughts of ill will. I think we all know what that is, when you get angry and upset about things. And thoughts of cruelty, now the cruelty one, here this is the one that is most, perhaps most, unusual, a bit more unusual than the other ones. What exactly does that mean? And what it means is vihingsa, vipaka. Vihingsa is precisely, if you remember Gandhi, he was always doing avihingsa, right, or ahingsa. His whole philosophy of life was ahingsa, non-violence, non-harm. So cruelty here means more like to harm somebody else, right? So thoughts of harming, if you like. But really, this word is really exists in opposition to compassion, to karuna. So what it means is very much like having a cold heart, being ruthless, if you like, right? Imagine yourself as a ruthless person, and all you want is to kind of move your career forward, whether it's in business or whatever it is, and you don't care about the feelings or the consequences for other people. You don't really have any ill will toward us. It's not really ill will. It's just that you don't care about them. You don't care what happens to them. And some people are like that, right? The whole world just falls by the kind of whatever happens to the rest of the world is irrelevant as long as I get things my way. That's what matters. So this is being cold-hearted. And it's interesting that being cold-hearted here is actually one of the bad intentions, right, on the Buddhist path. Having a cold heart, not caring about others, that in itself is actually a bad intention. So it is not just that you're coming from ill will or desire, it's actually this lack of care is also part of the problem here. So that I think is quite fascinating here. And then on the other hand, you have the opposite kind of thoughts, the thoughts of renunciation. Renunciation here is in direct opposition to sensual pleasures. So the main meaning of renunciation is to give up those sensual pleasures of the world, right? Moving away from that, moving in a different direction, moving to a different kind of happiness is what this means. But again, I would suggest to you that this is not the most important thing here. The most important thing is to overcome the ill will and the cold-heartedness. This is far more important, especially in lay life, in monastic life. It is very useful also to consider renunciation a little bit, because it becomes very hard to sustain the monastic life unless you renounce these things to some extent. But in lay life, much more important to focus on the overcoming the ill will and the cold-heartedness, because this is what makes life very unbearable, right? Anger and uncaring is what makes life very harsh and very full of enmity and really hostile, all those kind of things, which is exactly what we don't want, basically. So the first one is renunciation. Second one, thoughts of non-ill will. What does that mean? It's weird, thought of non-ill will. What exactly does that mean? And of course, one of the main things that it means, ill will means to be hostile to somebody. The opposite of hostility is friendliness, right? It's the exact opposite. It's metta, if you like, is what really is meant here by non-ill will. So why doesn't it say metta? Why does it say non-ill will? And the reason is that the ill will or non-ill will is broader than just metta. It can also include other very lofty things like a very high degree of equanimity, upekkha, for example, is also non-ill will. But the main meaning here is metta. Metta is by far the most important one, and it means like being friendly, the opposite of non-ill will. And then we have the opposite of non-cruelty, right? Non-cruelty is a sense of care, a sense of compassion for other people. You consider whether what you do will hurt them or not. You don't just go ahead and do things by caring. And that kind of consideration for other beings is part of this as well. You can see that how, you know, things become very, if you always consider how things will affect other people, and you start building up this good karma account very, very quickly because of that intention, that leaning of the mind in the right way. So, and then he says that when he divides these thoughts into two ways, he says, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute. Diligent, apamada, heedful, right? You are heedful, you are careful. You consider carefully what you're doing here. Heedful, I think, is a much better word than diligent. Diligent sounds like you're just working really hard all the time. That's not really the point. The point is that you are careful. You evaluate carefully. You don't do things rashly without consideration, right? This is what it means here, this word, apamada, in Pali here. Ardent, again, a strange word, right? It's not the kind of word we use in everyday life. People wonder what you're talking about if you use the word ardent. Ardent, what do you mean by that? Basically, it means energetic. You have energy here, right? You're applying yourself. You're not kind of being lazy or whatever here. So you are careful and you have energy. Often these things go together. If you have energy, it's more easy to be careful. If you're really kind of lazy and slack and sleepy, it's difficult to be carefully consider things because the mind is lacking that energy which enables you to carefully consider things. So, resolute, another word again meaning roughly the same thing. This means that you are applying yourself to the task really now. That's what that means. So, all of these words, you can see why they are important here, right? Because only when you have these qualities is it possible to reflect properly about things. But of course, what is interesting here as well is that what you will notice here, he says, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute. In other words, as I abided thus, it's referring to what he has just said before, right? Which is dividing the world into two classes of thoughts. So the idea of just dividing your thinking mind into bad thoughts and good thoughts, into wholesome thoughts and unwholesome thoughts, that very act is to dwell heedful, energetic, and having effort, right? That is enough to do that. And you can see here again what I was saying yesterday, that a lot of the Buddhist path is not about willpower, it is about wisdom power. Here specifically, energy is equated with wisdom. This division of thinking into two categories is about wisdom, right? You understand what is unwholesome, what is wholesome. This is all about wisdom, not about willpower or applying yourself, but thinking about things carefully. So that is fascinating. Now, perhaps you think that this is obvious, that these thoughts are wholesome, these are unwholesome. But I can assure you it is far less obvious than what you might think. Firstly, it's quite easy to understand why ill will is unwholesome. I think most of us get that quite quickly. Sensual pleasures, much more difficult to understand, right? You're just enjoying yourself, for goodness sake. What's the big deal? You're going out, you're having a nice meal somewhere, and I know Singaporeans like the nice meals. I can see why when I go to Singapore, all these nice food stalls and different kind of cuisine from different areas in the world. It's a great place to enjoy your food. But the point here is that, so this takes careful consideration. Why is it that sensuality, sensual pleasures, actually, in the end, are unwholesome? Right? It's not so easy to see this. I may talk about this a little bit more later on, but again, the main point is that ill will is a problem. So that is the first part of this, which can be hard to understand. The other part that is hard to understand is to understand this all the way to the most subtle and subtle aspects of this thinking here. Right? Ill will itself can be very, very subtle. It can be very kind of minute, or coldness of heart, not having compassion, can also be very subtle. So the idea here, when he says dividing it into two classes, it means a full understanding of these things. That is where it gets hard. This is the kind of sort of stuff that you discover in meditation practice sometimes. This is what Satipatthana is about to some extent, to be able to understand these different kinds of thought, how they arise, how they are abandoned, what they are, etc., etc. So you only can really only understand this fully once you have had some deep meditation, because then you have a comparative, something to compare it with. Okay, so this is the first thing. Then what happens, right? Then the Buddha says, and this is what I was saying before, the Buddha, he is really human, right? He says here, a thought of sensual desire arose in me. So after I had divided the thinking in this way, a thought of sensual desire arose. Right? The Buddha has these kind of thoughts. Later on, he also has thoughts of ill will and thoughts of ruthlessness as well. These are also comes up in his mind later on, we will see here. So again, no, these little things like that makes it humanizes the Buddha. He makes it one of us rather than something completely different. So thought of sensual desire arose in me. And then, of course, comes the interesting part, because now the Buddha is going to teach us, well, what do we do in that kind of situation? I understood thus, this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I considered this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided in me. When I considered this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. So this is what the Buddha does. So the first thing that he knows. It's a fire drill, I think. You up, right? No, whoa. That's good. Okay. Okay, so let us continue. So the first thing that he does, he says, this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. So he knows, right, what sensual desire is. And of course, the point here again is that he knows it all the way. So whenever any kind of sensual desire arises, he is aware of what's going on. And then comes the kind of the crucial thing here, right? He says that this leads to my own affliction, right? And then he says further down that when he considered this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. So the idea here again is this affliction here means like suffering, right? Or problem or harm or whatever. So as soon as you understand that something is harmful, as soon as you understand that it is a problem, right, you give it up. And this is kind of what happens. And remember, what is going on here is not that you use an act of willpower to give it up. The point is that if you reflect on it in the right way, you give it up automatically. It just happens. This is the point here. It's not something, yeah, I shouldn't do this, and then you force yourself not to do it. No, you realize deep down, this actually does really cause problems. And because you realize it deep down, your mind turns away from it all by itself. this is what this is about. Right? And the simile, which is very useful and very simple, which I always use to explain this, is like when if you are in your kitchen or something, and one of the hot plates has been on recently, but you're not aware of it, or you've forgotten about it, or whatever, and you put your hand on that hot plate, you don't have to think, should I take away my hand or not, right? No need to think that. It's automatic. You just bang, you withdraw it straight away. You don't even have to. This is a completely automatic reaction. And it's exactly the same thing with the mind. The mind that understands and sees that something is suffering, there is an automatic withdrawal, automatic turning away from that thing. So what we have to do here is to reflect, to understand why these things really are suffering. And the more powerfully we understand that, the more easily this kind of process of using wisdom happens all by itself. Right? So this is what we have to reflect on. Why is it dangerous? Why are sensual pleasures dangerous? Or more important, why is anger, why is ill will dangerous? And the more clearly you reflect on these things, the more obvious it becomes. Why are sensual pleasures dangerous? Well, there's lots of reasons for that. There are suttas about that elsewhere, but it first of all, they are dangerous because you tend to get stuck in them, right? And there is a higher happiness to be had. So why stick attached to the lower stuff when there's something higher to be had? They are dangerous because you tend to do bad things as a consequence of sensual pleasures. We want them, we desire them, we attach them, so we fight over them. We're willing to not follow our precepts because of sensual pleasures, right? All of these things happen as a consequence of sensual pleasures. We fight over the inheritance. All of these things actually go on. The more powerfully you understand that, the more easy it is to turn away from these things and turn to a kind of happiness that is not dangerous. That, of course, is the happiness of samadhi, the happiness of inner happiness that comes in the mind itself. So, it sounds easy, but it takes a lot of reflection to be able to understand this. So you know it is for your own harm. Do you want to harm yourself? Do you have compassion for yourself? Okay, if you don't want to harm yourself, this is what you should be doing. You don't want to harm others, right? This is like the bodhisattva practice. So you don't want to harm others also. Again, you don't follow this. Interesting here that harming yourself comes first. Maybe this is why the Theravadins are called selfish, right? Look after yourself first. I'm not sure about that. But the idea, of course, is that we are closest to ourselves. Our own happiness is closer to us than the happiness of others. So it sort of makes sense that we should look after ourselves first. And also, if you look after yourself first, you understand the problem, and then you actually have the ability to help others afterwards. It's a bit hypocritical if you go around helping everyone else, but you haven't got your own act together. So it kind of makes sense to look after yourself first of all. So that is, and then of course both as well, right? I'm not going to go into that, what that exactly means, but it is, if you wish, we can maybe talk about that later on. It's pretty much the same. What about just talk about now? And then of course it obstructs wisdom, right? The Pali word, panya nirodhika, it makes wisdom cease, that's pretty much what it means. And if you have some idea that wisdom is good, I'm sure most of you would agree with that wisdom is really kind of crucial, then of course the fact that it makes it cease is rather terrible news. Right? Why does it make wisdom cease? Because once we are in the clutches of desire, in the clutches of ill will or whatever it is, it distorts our outlook. We don't see the world like the way it actually is seen by somebody who is calm and peaceful. And because it distorts our outlook, it makes us do things that are stupid, that leads to long-term harm and consequences. If there's something that you desire a lot, you have a vested interest in getting that object. Don't see it for what it actually is anymore. This is where we end up doing all kinds of silly things as a consequence. It's fairly easy to see this. If you're very angry, you end up doing things that later on you wish you hadn't done because your mind is distorted. You cannot see clearly what is happening. it destroys this beautiful quality of wisdom. Why? What is it about wisdom that is so beautiful then? Well, wisdom is this ability to precisely to understand about happiness and suffering, where happiness lies, where suffering lies, and then move towards happiness and away from suffering. That's what wisdom is like, right? If you have, I'm not sure many of you have had some person in your life that you have would go to if you had a problem, right? Maybe some auntie or a grandparent or a teacher or a spiritual guide or whoever it is. We all have these people in our life that we go to if there is a problem, right? Somebody who can see clearly. Why is it that we go to those people? Well, often because they can help us. They have the ability to see through the problem, but the ability is to listen to us, right? And then they come up with some very simple solution. All you have to do is this. And think, wow, so obvious. Thank you for your wisdom. These are the wise people in our lives. They can resolve issues for us and make us move forward. So this is really what wisdom is. It's different from intelligence. Intelligence is that you can be incredibly intelligent, but really foolish at the same time. Yet wisdom is this quality where you don't even have to be very intelligent. It's just that you have an understanding about happiness and suffering in the world. So that is bad news, that it leads to the ending of wisdom. So because of that, then he turns away from that. He causes difficulties, right? Always problems if you have too much desires and ill will. Endless problems comes from that. It leads away from Nibbana. So, interesting here, the Buddha uses the word Nibbana, but remember, he wasn't awakened yet. So what does he mean by Nibbana if he wasn't awakened? He wouldn't know what it was, right? He is searching for this. He's searching for the end of all suffering. So what does it mean? And remember here that what it means in early Buddhism, the word Nibbana means to extinguish something. So it means like it is away from this idea of extinguishing things. The main thing that we are extinguishing is precisely the defilements, right? And suffering itself. You want to extinguish this. So what this means is that we are moving towards more defilements, not away from, not towards extinguishing these things, but from making these things worse. So Nibbana has an ordinary meaning in the Pali language, and I think it's useful to translate words like Nibbana. If you don't translate it, people think, oh yeah, Nibbana, they kind of read anything they want into that word. And then it gets all this kind of dodgy meanings. It got nothing to do with what the Buddha meant by these things. It means to extinguish defilements. Because why? Because ill will burns. Desire burns. It makes you hot and restless and craving and all of these kind of things. So, when he thought about any of these things, right, he abandoned this. So again, this only works when you have reflected upon this in a fair amount and you understand this fairly deeply. Only then is it possible to abandon it just by reflecting in this way. So you have to kind of build up this wisdom inside of you, right? And think about it again and again and again. So and this then helps you moving away. Just like we were talking this morning about the ways of overcoming anger and resentment, this kind of ties in very closely with that as well. These are two ways of dealing with the same kind of problems. Okay, so that is the sensual desire. Then comes the more important part. As I abided thus, heedful, energetic, and with effort, a thought of ill will arose in me. A thought of harming or ruthlessness arose in me. I thought thus, this thought, this ruthlessness has arisen in me. This leads to my own suffering, to other suffering, to the suffering of both. It causes wisdom to cease. It leads to difficulties, and it leads away from extinguishment. When I considered thus, it subsided in me. When the thought of ruthlessness arose in me, I abandoned it, I removed it, I did away with it. So, an important point that I didn't mention before is this idea of abandoning it, of removing it, and doing away with it, right? This is actually an important point here. Sometimes these words are translated even more strongly. I think Bhikkhu Bodhi, he translates one of these words as obliterate. Right? Obliterate. Sounds really kind of, sounds like a lot of willpower you're using there. But what is interesting here is, of course, that you see these strong words about removing and doing away with and obliterating, they are actually used in the context of using wisdom. And this is kind of the whole point of this passage. It shows you that overcoming the defilements again, as I was saying yesterday, is all about wisdom power, not about willpower. And here it is very clear that it's about wisdom. It's about how you think about these things. It is not about, you know, clenching your teeth and pressing the tongue against the roof of your mouth and forcing these things out. No, it's just about being wise. Right? And then when you are wise in this way, then you abandon it, then you do away with it, then you remove it, then you obliterate it. And the point here is that if you, as I was saying yesterday or whenever it was, if you try to use willpower, all you are really doing is kind of holding it down for a while, kind of suppressing it, right? As soon as you remove that pressure on those thoughts, as soon as you take away the willpower, they pop back up again. Because you haven't really dealt with an underlying problem. And this is why if you use willpower, you never remove it, you never do away with it. Even though these terms may sound like willpower, actually, if you use willpower, you cannot do this. So this has nothing to do with willpower. The only way you can really remove things, the only way you can deal with things in a really deep and profound way is through wisdom. Because when you understand that this is a problem, and your mind turns away from this, then you're actually dealing with the root of the problem itself. And when you deal with the root of the problem, then it is abolished for a long time afterwards. So this is how you remove things. This is why wisdom is far more powerful than willpower. Sometimes we have to use a bit of willpower in life, because sometimes things don't get too excessive, right? And you just have to force yourself not to do something stupid or silly. And that's okay. Sometimes willpower has a place. But most of the time, it's far more powerful to try to reflect on things in the right way. So this is how you do that. And here, again, the most important reflections come here about ill will, understanding why ill will is a problem. Right? I really advise you to consider that carefully if you can. Ill will, first of all, it's quite obvious why there's a problem, but you know, things like nobody likes angry people, right? So if you're angry all the time, you're not going to have any friends. That's already a negative thing. People don't going to like you. Whereas if you have a lot of metta and kindness and friendliness, you tend to attract people. You become like this magnet I was mentioning before. So this is obviously, this is a good reason in its own right, right? Nobody wants to be lonely and alone. We all want to have company. So you have, by having metta, you're actually attracting people to you, and you're avoiding this kind of loneliness. This is the first thing, very obvious one. The other thing is that one of the reasons why we all sometimes get angry is because we want to control people. We want you to get them to do certain things. And of course, sometimes if somebody gets really angry, you're kind of a bit afraid, right? So, okay, I better do what they say. But in the long run, it's not a good motivating force. In the long run, anger turns people away rather than towards you. So instead of getting angry, which is a short-term solution but a long-term problem, try to find a way which is a long-term solution. In the short term, it might not work as well, but in the long run, it's going to be powerful. Right? So you speak kindly, you try to explain wisely why this is the right way to do things, why you should be doing it this way. And you show that you have the interest of the other person at heart. This is kind of the crucial issue, right? If you can show to the other person, actually, I'm doing this for your good. I'm actually thinking about you when I say this. If you're angry, it's so obvious that you haven't got the other person's interest at heart, right? You're angry because of your own personal issues. But if you say things in a nice way and explain it in a nice way, then it is fairly obvious that you are thinking about the other person. So again, you know, anger, sometimes it works short term, but in the long run, it actually can, it backfires badly usually. So these are some of the issues. And of course, in the broader context of things, anger always leads to conflicts, right, with other people. And in the broader scale of things, it leads to, I think, all kinds of community problems and international problems even, right? If you have leaders that don't have a sense of kind of even temperament and all of these kind of things. And so does desire, by the way. Desire also leads to massive international conflict because we want to control resources. We want to make sure that our nation is well supplied, right? So you kind of go to war on these very dodgy premises. And you see this in the sutras as well. This is the sort of reason that I found there as well. So again, you need to, again, by reflecting on this, it becomes very clear. And it turns you off anger. It turns you off being ruthless, not being caring. And it turns your mind in a different direction. Okay. So, then... the next paragraph here, I'm going to switch around the next two paragraphs, and the reason for that is because there is a Chinese version of the sutta, it exists in the Chinese canon, and that has the reverse order between these two paragraphs, and I think that makes better sense in the context. So maybe there has been a shuffling of paragraphs in the Pali, and I think the version that exists in the Madhyama Agama, in Chinese translation, it's probably better, has a better preservation of this. So, then, what comes then is a simile. Just as in the last month of the rainy season, in the autumn, when the crops thicken, a cowherd would guard his cows by constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. Why is that? Because he sees that he could be flogged, imprisoned, fined and blamed if he let them stray into the crops. So too, I saw in unwholesome qualities the danger, degradation and defilement, and in wholesome qualities the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. So this gives, again, this nice little similes, right, which the sutras are so famous for. So, you know, you can see these cows, right, you can see all these crops out there, and usually cows, all they have to eat is grass, but now they really would like to get into those crops, right? But the cowherd realizes that if I allow these cows to go wherever they want, I'll be in serious trouble. So he will get flogged or imprisoned or blamed or whatever. Just like you get into trouble if you allow your mind to stray into unwholesome qualities. In the same way, this cowherd gets into problem if he allows the cows to stray. So your mind is a bit like a cow, that is what it's saying here. So, you know, it needs to be kind of under control. And it's actually quite nice, the idea that the mind is like a cow, because cows just follow their habits, right? Oh yeah, the nice crops are over there, so we go over there. Cows don't really reflect very much. They don't think, oh, what is wise, you know? That's not how cows work. They're pretty much automatic. And we are also pretty much automatic a lot of the time, right? We are following habits, following ways we have always been doing things. The mind is running down the same old track. So it's not as, you know, it's funny, but there's also some truth to this, that we are more just instinctual, perhaps is the right word, than sometimes we would like to be. So you tap and poke your mind a little bit, right? Tap it this way, tap it that way. Okay, mind, don't go this way. And then that tapping here is using wisdom power, most of all, because if you understand things, the mind will do what you want it to do. If you don't understand, you just want to force the mind becomes rebellious, because the mind wants happiness. Mind wants happiness, it has to understand where the happiness lies, and then the mind will be happy to go there. If the mind thinks that you are withholding happiness from it, that's what's going here, then it will rebel, right? Sensual pleasure, what's the big deal? Sensual pleasure is nice, right? Oh, no worries about that. Just enjoy yourself, for goodness sake. Why don't you want me to go to sensual pleasures? This is what the mind is going to argue. And then you say, listen, mind, okay, this is a problem here. Oh, yeah, okay, fair enough. And then the mind doesn't go there, right? It's like
dealing with it fine a little bit. You have to be very kind of patient with yourself. So that is what happens there. And then it says that he saw right in unwholesome state, he saw the danger. So the mind sees the danger and it goes in different directions. The degradation, the okara, means like to make something low. Right? The high mind. High mind is the mind which is free of defilements. You get a mind a little bit like the devas, like the gods. A mind which is beautiful and free of all these kind of things. You can see why you have the hierarchies, right? And the higher up you get, the more free your mind is of defilements. It is less degraded. It's less kind of kept low. There's a certain lowness. The coarser your sensual pleasures are, there's a certain lowness about that. The more anger you have, there's a lowness about that as well. The less you have of those things, like you're soaring, and the mind feels that sense of purity as a consequence. So, and then defilement, which is very similar to the idea of okara, to hold things low. It is defiled. It is not pure. It's like you are dirty. You feel kind of slightly dirty by these things. And in the wholesome state, the opposite, right? The blessing of renunciation, the blessing of being free from these things, not being attached, not being kind of engulfed by the defilements and all this kind of stuff, but being free from that. The aspect of cleansing, getting that dirt removed. And you can feel that, right? You can feel it in your mind. You know that this is good. It's not just about being goody-goody, right? That's not really the point here. The point is that actually it feels very nice when you do this. You know that this is a higher state of mind. This is a higher state of existence. It brings more happiness, more real happiness. And you can feel that when you are there. That's how this understanding actually arises. And then we come to the previous paragraph. Bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, he has abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of ill will or thoughts upon ruthlessness, he has abandoned non-ruthlessness to cultivate thoughts of ruthlessness. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of ruthlessness. So this, and again, is one of those very nice little paragraphs, right? The idea that, yes, there is work to be done, so to speak. There is right reflection, there is wrong reflection. But as you keep on reflecting in this way, there comes a time when it becomes quite easy. It becomes the inclination of your mind, right? And so the more you do this, the more you incline in a different direction, eventually your mind just goes there by itself. There comes a time when metta is much more natural for you. There comes a time when being caring and having compassion becomes more natural. And then the mind just goes there, it becomes almost automatic. It's never 100% automatic. The defilements are always there in the background, but it becomes easier. This is kind of the beauty of this path, right? As you go along, just like the five precepts, initially you think, oh wow, we're going to keep this five precepts. Wow, this is really demanding. Right? But after a while, you don't think like that anymore. It's just second nature to keep the five precepts. Or the monk's precept is just automatic. You wouldn't even occur to you to break these precepts anymore. And in the same way, with the thinking mind, it becomes automatic after a while. So that's why, this is one of the reasons why it is it is not as arduous and difficult as you might think. Okay, then comes the other side of the coin, right? We have looked at how to develop, get rid of the bad thoughts. Now comes the opposite side of the coin. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, or heedful, energetic, and full of effort, a thought of renunciation arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, to others' affliction, or to the suffering of both.
It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to extinguishment. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from stillness. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and stilled it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained. Right now we are coming to the reverse side of the coin, all these good qualities. The first one being a thought of renunciation, of giving up sensuality, giving up sensual pleasures. So you get this feeling, wow, I've got to give this up, great, you know, let me get rid of this. It's like a thought that takes you to samadhi, takes you to peace in meditation. Meditation, if you get a little bit of peace in your meditation while you're here, it means that is inclining towards renunciation, right? It's a similar kind of thing. Because thoughts of sensuality, they're always full of craving and desire. It's the opposite of peace. So that already is a little bit heading in that direction. And then he knows that this is not dangerous, right? Even if I think about this all the time, there is nothing to fear from this. It does, in other words, it doesn't lead me to do bad things. You don't do bad things based on this, you only do good things based on that. And because of that, it's not dangerous. You can never make bad karma based on renunciation. That's basically, essentially what it boils down to, I suppose. But, and this is kind of, now we're taking this a step further. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. You know what it's like if you think all day, think, eventually you start to feel tired. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And then when the mind is strained, it is very difficult to get into good meditation and samadhi. If you're really tired one day, you come in here, you start nodding, right? Oh, can't keep awake, and then you're snoring, all this kind of stuff, right? And if you do that, that's okay. Please snore. I always have compassion for people who snore because I think, oh, at least they are getting a good rest. What a wonderful thing that is. So please, so that's not too bad to snore a little bit. But ideally, it's even better if you can be awake, right? If you can be awake, even better. So let's try to kind of get the absolute maximum benefit out of this. So this is why, at the end of the day, you give up thinking altogether, even though there are certain kind of thoughts that are good, they are not problematic. No thinking at all is even better than that, because then the mind gets a chance to rest. And this is one of the things that you will find, the more peaceful your meditation has been, when you come out of that meditation afterwards, you feel energized, right? You feel kind of more awake. You feel like you have energy again. This is the powerful thing about meditation practice. The more deep that meditation goes, the more energy you have afterwards. Sometimes enormous amounts of energy. You don't know where all this energy comes from. But it's a different kind of energy from the kind of energy people normally have. Normally when we have energy, it's kind of slightly restless. Right? Or it's agitated. It's not an energy which is peaceful. We do things, not so much because we want to do things, but we do things because we are restless. We can't really keep still. For a lot of people, that is the case. But this energy here is very different type of energy. It's an energy that is peaceful. It's an energy you can just sit there and do absolutely nothing, but just feel this powerful buzz of energy inside without doing anything whatsoever. You just feel that the mind is incredibly powerful. That is what it feels like. Yeah? And you feel joy at the same time. You feel mindfulness at the same time, right? All of these beautiful things coming together at that particular point. So that is what you, if you want to attain the samadhi, that's what you then have to do. And what the Buddha then says is that, well, there's nothing dangerous with this thing, but because I don't want to strain the mind, I want to have the energy and the clarity, what he does then, instead of thinking about all this stuff all the time, he instead steadies the mind internally,
quiets it down, brings it to singleness, and stills it. And all of these terms, they are terms that refer us to the jhanas, right? Here we're really talking about the jhana states, profound states of stillness and beauty, if you want. Concentrated is the standard translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi, and stillness is the one Ajahn Brahm uses. And I think for very good reasons, because concentration gives the wrong ideas. Why is that? So that the mind should not be strained. So what you're seeing here is a gradual movement, right? First of all, we overcome the bad thinking and move towards the good thinking. Then we abandon the good thinking altogether and we go to samadhi. Getting the things in the right order is so important. You cannot go straight from bad thinking to samadhi. You have to go via the good thinking. So first of all, learn to think in the right way. That's why I put so much emphasis on your attitude in your meditation practice. Right? The attitude has to be right. Attitude just means the same as right thinking here. The attitude of compassion, of kindness, all of these kind of things. That is what actually will lead you to samadhi. So do things in the right order, right? Everything has to be in the right order. You skip a few steps, you're not going to get to the goal, right? You can't go straight from, you know, learning the multiplication table to calculus. You have to take all the steps in between, otherwise you're going to be lost when you get to the calculus. It's not a very good simile, but it gives you a rough idea of how this works. Stage by stage, the first part here, the overcoming of the unwholesome thoughts, moving to the wholesome one, that's the right effort. The stilling of the right thoughts, going to samadhi, that's called satipatthana practice, like watching the breath. And then the samadhi that comes from that, that is the samma samadhi, the jhanas. That is the last, the eighth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. You can see the factors here, one after the other. That may not have been obvious to you, but having read this universe for a long time, I have the advantage of being able to point that out to you. So there you are, that's how that works. Okay, let's just finish off this sutta fairly quickly. There's only a few paragraphs left to come. So as I abided thus diligent, heedful, energetic, and with effort, a thought of metta, of friendliness, of loving kindness, of benevolence, right, arose in me. And then they have contracted that whole paragraph, a thought of compassion, of being warm-hearted, of being caring, arose in me. I thought thus, this thought of caring has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own suffering, to other suffering, or to the suffering of both. It supports wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads towards the extinguishment of the defilements. If I were to ponder upon this thought for an entire night or a day and night, I see nothing to fear from it. Only good karma comes from this. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from stillness. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to unity, to singleness, and stilled it. Why is that? So my mind should not be strained. So again, exactly the same idea as before, but this time focusing on the other aspects of thinking. Desire and renunciation, but ill will versus metta and that sort of thing. And then I come to the simile again. Just as in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops have been brought inside the villages, a cowherd would guard his cows while staying at the root of a tree or out in the open, since he need only be mindful that the cows are there. So too, there was need for me only to be mindful that those qualities were there. Right now, they can see everything becoming much easier, right? There's no crops that the cows can stray into. There's no thoughts, bad thoughts, that the mind can stray into. So because of that, you can start to chill a little bit. You can just relax, right? Sitting back at the root of a tree, or sitting back on your chair here, right? Only thinking nice thoughts, and just relaxing, and having a good time. And this is kind of part of the
beautiful thing about this path is as you move along the path, it becomes easier. In the beginning, you have to tap your mind this way and that. But after a while, wow, you just sit back and you just relax. And you enjoy yourself so much more. As you move on, the path becomes easier and easier. This is part of what he is talking about here. And all you have to do is to be mindful, right? This is one of the important aspects of mindfulness, to know what your mind is doing, to be aware that your mind is doing appropriate stuff. So you have that mindfulness, but you don't need to do much more than that, because the mind is already behaving quite nicely. Occasionally the mind may be straying in the wrong place, you bring it back again, using these kinds of techniques we have been talking about. And then you kind of relax again. And all you have to do is to be mindful that those qualities are present in the mind. Of course, this can often be difficult, right? Especially in everyday life, if you are very busy and things are going on. But even in everyday life, you can do this at least to some extent. Sometimes you catch yourself getting angry and think, wait a minute, what is going on here? Okay, what can I do? How can I change the outlook here? And you think about things differently. Easier to do on retreat, but it can also be done to some extent at least in ordinary daily life. So, but bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu thinks, frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of metta, thoughts of compassion, he has abandoned the thought of cold-heartedness, right? To cultivate the thought of compassion, or the thought of renunciation, or the thought of metta. And then his mind inclines to those thoughts of compassion. So now your mind is inclining in a different direction. You have literally changed your habits, right? These habits that can be so hard to change because they are so ingrained in us. Our mind is like this train. You know what a train is like? A train, when it gathers up speed, a train is incredibly heavy. This kind of steel construction that hurtles along, maybe 200 or 300 kilometers an hour. These days you have these really high speed trains. And it takes a long time for that train to stop but turn direction. And your mind is a bit like that. The habits are so ingrained. The way you have been doing things for lifetime after lifetime after lifetime means you're hurtling along in this habit. So what you have to do is learn to gradually turn your mind around, turn it in a different direction by using wisdom power. And eventually your mind will be going 180 degrees in the opposite direction, and it will gather speed, right? Eventually it will be hurting 200 kilometers an hour in the direction of metta, in the direction of compassion, in the direction of even of renunciation, if you get to that. And then when your mind is hurtling 200 kilometers an hour towards those things, wow, then things become really nice, and really life becomes so easy and pleasant for you as a consequence. This is what we're trying to do here. It takes a lot of work, it takes a lot of commitment and perseverance, as I was saying, but wow, if there's anything in life worth doing, this is the kind of stuff that really is worth doing. Yeah? And then the very last paragraph, the Buddha says, tireless energy was aroused in me, unremitting mindfulness. Unremitting means like mindfulness that doesn't slack off, right? Strong mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled. My mind stilled and unified. And this is what happens automatically when you are free of hindrances, you're free of these negative thoughts, energy starts to arise. And I'm sure you can relate to that, right? Sometimes when you are very negative and dark, no energy in the mind is really tired and had enough. But sometimes when you feel more purity inside of yourself, the energy comes with that. On days when you feel really kind-hearted and really good to everybody, usually you have energy as well, right? You're kind of skipping along and feeling happy. Mindfulness becomes powerful. And one of the main reasons mindfulness becomes powerful is because, wow, things are so nice, right? This is the thing about turning the present moment into the pleasant moment. If the pleasant moment is nice, mindfulness is easy, is no longer a problem.
The body is tranquil and untroubled when you lay, put away all the cravings and that kind of problems. The body also relaxes. And the mind is stilled and unified. And the reason is because when things are beautiful, it is easy to keep your mind on those things. This is the draw card in the meditation practice. You set all the happiness. It becomes the glue, the thing which attracts you. And then it's easy to practice meditation as a consequence. Okay, so there you are. The beautiful Dvaita Vitakka Sutta on two kinds of thoughts. So again, if you have any questions on that, there is a possibility to ask questions over here now. Now it is even more possible. So let's just call it a day for now, and then we'll see you again at 8 o'clock this evening. Let's pay respect to Buddha Mahasangha first of all.